if you're going to draw a long knife, you better make sure it's sharp. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
As always, Barry, it's great to be back with you. A lot of interesting things to talk about today.
Well, yes, there is. And what we're going to talk about today is a little bit of a continuation of the topic we started yesterday. And that is the meteoric, it seems, rise of the star of U.S. Senator from Kentucky, Rand Paul, who has caught a lot of national spotlight for his willingness to stand up to the Obama administration and, as it was revealed after his 13-hour filibuster, stand up to some of the members of his own GOP Senate caucus and stand for the Constitution, individual liberties, and the safety and security of us all, I believe. But you know what they say, Chuck, no good deed goes unpunished.
That's right.
Especially if that good deed is interpreted as a opening salvo in the presidential primary battles. And I think that's what the establishment Republicans in this land believe is happening with Rand Paul and his rise on the floor and his standing without releasing the floor for 13 hours last week, and I'm finally relenting almost midnight when he just couldn't hold out any longer, and he had to go answer the call of nature.
Yeah, that's it. I mean,
or else the filibuster might still be going on yet this week, I believe.
Trying to figure out how Strom Thurmond did it for 24 straight hours.
Well, you know what? Strom Thurmond was made of much sterner stuff than most of the politicians of the day today. But Rand Paul may have found a little bit of that elixir. But, again, as we mentioned earlier, no good deed goes unpunished. And so we had John McCain and Lindsey Graham both out there maligning and inveighing against Senator Rand Paul and some of his fellow senators like Ted Cruz of Texas, Marco Rubio of Florida. You know, those young bucks who don't know enough to sit down and just let the president tell you what we're going to do and then just vote that way. You know, Lindsey Graham even going so far to say is, well, we were having dinner with the president. It's so embarrassing that he's up there grandstanding while we're trying to get serious business done and basically fawning over Barack Obama and at a dinner party.
Well, Barry, what's happening here is that the far left of the party is uniting to attempt to assassinate Paul's character and his reputation quick before he can become a troublemaker in presidential politics like his father was. Now, in order to show that, we are going to be talking about an article by a fellow named Michael Gerson, who's an opinion writer for the Washington Post. And this is posted in the Washington Post. It's called Rand Paul Masks His True Worldview. Well, I'm going to say, before we start on this, I'm going to give you some information about Michael Gerson, and we can find out if Michael Gerson might be masking his true worldview.
Oh, I'm going to guess right now that the answer to that is yes.
All right. This is from his Wikipedia page. He's an op-ed columnist for the Washington Post, a policy fellow with the One Campaign. Are you familiar with the One Campaign?
Not offhand, but I'm going to look that up while we're talking.
Well, I have it here.
Oh, you already have it. Okay, good.
It's an international, nonpartisan, nonprofit advocacy campaign for increasing government funding for an effectiveness of international aid programs. One was originally founded by a coalition of 11 nonprofit humanitarian and advocacy organizations, including Oxfam, World Vision Data, Bread for the World, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. This is not exactly a hall of fame of conservative groups. This was also formed by leaders Tom Daschle and Bill Frist together. Again, more liberal Republicans. Okay, by the way, the one thing is based on a song, won by who? Who would you guess?
U2.
U2.
Yeah, because Bono is front and center on their website.
Now, here's another one for you, Barry. He's a visiting fellow with the Center for Public Justice.
Oh, lovely. Okay. And if I remember correctly, Michael Gerson was either a speechwriter or an analyst in the Bush White House.
Both.
Okay. Boy, yeah, I do remember. Okay.
He was a member of the White House Iraq group. Okay. He's also a senior fellow at The Council on Foreign Relations.
Oh, well, isn't that just lovely?
And he was George W. Bush's chief speechwriter. This guy's a piece of work. This guy's a piece of work. Folks, if you really thought George Bush was a conservative, all you have to do is look at the background of this fellow to find out. This is his chief speechwriter and was a member of his White House Iraq group. This is the guy who was sitting behind George Bush whispering in his ear, one of the many. But the fact is that Michael Gerson is nothing like a conservative. And what is showing up, I see here, is a phrase that shows up very early in this screed that he wrote. He says, since arriving in the Senate in 2011, Rand Paul has been probing here and there for issues of populist resonance. In other words, he doesn't really believe it, but he's probing for a weakness. That's the implication here. Audit the secretive, sinister Federal Reserve. Rein in those TSA screeners patting down little girls. In each instance, Paul has evoked the fear of oppressive government without tipping over into the paranoia of his father's most dedicated supporters. Get it? Those of us who want to preserve, protect, defend, and use the Constitution as a tool are paranoid. Well, he's saying that his message has been diluted, domesticated, decaffeinated version of the ideology that motivated Ron Paul's presidential races. Yes, how awful that we would talk about a return to the Constitution. Now, as we mentioned yesterday, that is a goal. These guys cannot have their feet held to the fire regarding their fidelity to the Constitution because, as we said yesterday, the United States Constitution poses no threat to our current form of government.
Now, I want to draw your attention to something about Mike Gerson as well, Chuck, and I think this is, like, I would say probably the apex of hypocrisy coming from him with that comment, because I knew that there was another thing that Mike Gerson had done, and that is he has written a book. Well, he's actually written a couple, but this one was specific. It's called Heroic Conservatism. I'm sure some of our listeners have probably seen this book, or some of them may have even read it, but its subtitle is Why Republicans Need to Embrace America's Ideals and Why They Deserve to Fail If They Don't. Now, Chuck, I don't know between you and me, but one of the base ideals of America is our constitutional form of government.
Yes, our Republican form of government.
That's and right.
What he is appealing to is a Democratic form of government, and these are not compatible.
So I find it very hypocritical to have Gerson waxing eloquent about all of the shortcomings of Rand or Ron Paul and their views. Now, especially his big issue or his big problem is with their foreign policy viewpoints. He uses the discussion about drones against Americans on U.S. soil, honestly, really as a launching point to basically talking about how dangerous, and I forget exactly how he puts it, but this whole idea of their foreign policy positions being very, very potentially dangerous, because he says Rand Paul has described himself as a foreign policy realist, but this isn't the ideology of Chuck Hagel or others skeptical of democracy promotion and nation building. Paul's constitutional foreign policy, he puts that in quotes, denies the legal basis for the war on terror, would place severe constraints on the executive in defending the nation, and hints at the existence of an oppressive national security state. Well, I got news for Mike Gerson. I believe Rand Paul's right on all of those particular issues, that I don't believe that there really is a legal basis for a war on a tactic. I don't necessarily believe that it's up to the executive alone in defending the nation. I believe that that was really left to the several states and to the militias. There are certain roles for federal military. And then this whole national security state, well, how does Mike Gerson explain a Department of Homeland Security buying 1.6 billion rounds of ammunition and 2,700 mine-resistant armored personnel carriers and fully automatic rifles that they deny the public or are getting ready to deny the public the right to have? That really sounds to me like an oppressive national security state getting ready to be formed.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, what he's attempting to do is poison the well with this talk about a future Hitler-like leader earlier in the article. And in fact, this is exactly how Germany became a police state. Now, you can't blame everything on Hitler. For instance, gun registration. The lists that Hitler used were actually put together by the Weimar Republic. And the reason the Weimar Republic registered guns was because the Weimar Republic was not a popular government, and they feared revolution, and therefore they figured they'd better have a list of guns to go confiscate if any rebellion broke out, as it had in the late teens after the war in the early 20s. So the Weimar Republic developed this gun registration list, and when Hitler decided to seize power, the first guns that he seized were owned by whom?
Well, Jews. Jews, yes, of course.
And then later, anyone who might be considered a threat to the regime, there, you have to remember that Hitler was elected Chancellor of Germany, but he only got 34% of the vote. He had to put together a coalition government, and then what happened? They had an attack from a foreign entity that burned down their parliament building. So what did they do? They immediately gave Hitler dictatorial powers. Sound familiar?
Slightly, yes.
Yeah, this scenario is not something that is the result of paranoia. It's the result of studying history. Now, Gerson should know that. Anybody who basically attempts to make money by writing a book about American ideals should really have some form of a grasp of history, especially if he's going to be a presidential speechwriter. But he takes on a don't confuse me with facts attitude here and essentially goes about the business of carving up Paul's character and reputation. Like we said, he's brought out the long knives.
Well, I think I just want to bring up something else, and I'm pulling this up from the Wikipedia article on Mike Gerson, because I think it's very, very telling. And there's a reference with footnotes about an article in the Atlantic magazine by Matthew Scully, who was a colleague of Gerson's, a co-speechwriter in the Bush administration. And he basically says here, he says, "It was always like this working with Mike. No good deed went unreported, and many things that never happened were reported as fact. For all our chief speechwriter's finer qualities, the firm adherence to factual narrative is not a strong point," unquote.
Wow. Well, somebody's got him pegged. As one can tell by this article, it's luckily it's an opinion piece because it's a screed. It really bears no resemblance to anything actually factual. Sure, it's got little underlined things that you can go around and follow his thread of thought. But this thing about his real target is the war on terrorism, his target should be the war on terrorism. First of all, that's a propaganda phrase. Barry, as we need to explain, because we get new listeners all the time, you can't fight a war against a battle tactic, and terror is a battle tactic that is used by combatants. If you're going to declare war, you declare war against nations and combatants. Now, if you don't have a specific nation you can declare war against, then Congress is free to authorize letters of marque and reprisal from their powers in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. And what that means is not the president, not the executive branch, not the CIA, but the Congress authorizes the issuance of these letters where these people can be killed or captured under specific circumstances. Yes, did these people blow up our buildings? Yes. Did they plan to do some from a foreign country? Yes. Are they being harbored by those countries? Yes. We should make it clear that if they don't give those people up for trial in this country or try them themselves and put them in jail, that could very possibly lead to some diplomatic repercussions up to including war. But you don't just basically willy-nilly go around and start putting people, rounding them up and putting them in prison camps and holding them indefinitely. You either prove your case and give them sentences or execute them or you let them go. And you especially don't do it to Americans. And that's the whole point behind the drone war, Barry. You know, the Defense Department has wiped out all the information, basically, that's out there on how many people have been killed with drones. Now, last report, it was somewhere over 3,000.
Yes. But the Air Force, who had that up on their website, has since taken it down and caused it to be buried behind a firewall, I believe.
Well, big shock. But basically, Barry, what this is, Michael Gerson is a useful front man for the McCain,
Lindsey Graham wing of the party.
A wing of the party. And believe me, the current RNC chair, who's Rince Priebus, loves these guys and hates Rand Paul. Hates him. Wants him gone. Doesn't want us to have anything to do with any more Sarah Palins, any more Michelle Bachmans, none of that. He doesn't want any of it. He wants to run more McCains and Grahams. Well, thanks, but I think I'd pass on that. I'm looking at the clock, Barry. We're out of time. Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.